Welcome back to the Border Patrol on Sports Radio 810 WHB. Thank you to our guests so far today, Jamie Bluma, Mark Boerichter. We'll talk to Mike DeCourcy in the next segment. But let's talk a little baseball now. The Royals are 6-4, and they're coming off a four-game sweep of the Chicago White Sox. And tonight, out of Kauffman Stadium, 6:40 first pitch, they take on the Houston Astros with Cole Reagans on the mound for the Royals. Game two will have Seth Lugo, and then game three, Brady Singer. To talk about the Red Hot Royals, we have Andy Rogers from MLB.com on the show. Andy, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good. How are you guys?
It's a lot more fun to cover a team when they start off hot and they're winning. Different vibe, huh?
Absolutely. And this is what the Royals needed. They needed to get off to a better start. I think 6-4 is right where, you know, they need to be. And going into a tough slate against the Astros. And, you know, got the Blue Jays next week as well. So it'll be an interesting rest of the month.
So with any new team, we have to wait a while as they, you know, develop an identity and we figure out the true strengths and weaknesses. But early on, the bullpen was a concern for many people, especially after that series in Baltimore. So even though the level of competition wasn't as high as it was against Baltimore, I thought it was very important that the bullpen had a good series against the White Sox. The bullpen did not give up an earned run against the White Sox. And so that allowed, number one, the Royals to win those games, and number two, the bullpen to build some confidence. Tell me what you saw from this bullpen that suggests that they're figuring things out, and maybe it won't be as bad as some people feared when they watched the first week of the season.
Yeah, absolutely. The Orioles, they're a really good team. That's a tough lineup to face. And the fact that the Royals were in every single one of those games, I thought, there's no moral victories, but I really do think that's something that they can kind of hang their hat on and know, like, hey, we can be in the games with a team like this. So that's good to walk out of there. You'd like to walk out of there with, you know, another win or so, but it's good to say, like, we can hang with these teams. They're not beating up on us. And then to come in and beat the White Sox all four games the way that they did it with good pitching and good offense, that's what good teams should do, is beat up on those bad teams like that. So that was really good to see. And see the bullpen kind of stabilize back there. We saw a little bit of a different structure in the back end of, of late in games. And I think that's another sign of what the Royals are trying to do. And they're trying to win, and they're going to make changes if they deem it necessary to make sure that they're winning as many games as they can.
I guess I shouldn't have been surprised by this, because I know how bad the last 2 years have been. But reading from Andy's article that the last time the Royals were above 500 was April 10th of 2022.
Oh, well.
I don't know. Andy, I was like, oh, I mean, not even a day above 500 since April of 2022, but here they are. And you mentioned the bullpen, so I want to ask you about that with the reshuffling of it a little bit, because I said to Steven back when they got off to the bad start, I know it's deflating to lose games late when your bullpen blows it, but I would rather be in the Royals situation where the bullpen is the question mark and the starting rotation seems to be legit, because you can massage things with the bullpen a little bit. How much have they figured it out with what they've changed, and how much of it's still kind of a work in progress in terms of the way they construct their bullpen right now?
I think it's still a work in progress. You know, we've seen now the past couple of games, James McArthur take over the ninth instead of Will Smith. And he had a clean eighth inning on Sunday, which was really good to see, kind of a bounce-back inning for him, which I think, you know, as we go forward, Matt Quatrero is probably going to play the matchups a little bit more rather than say, this is our ninth inning guy, this is our closer, this is who we're going to put in a safe situation all the time. Now, that can change as, you know, if James McArthur continues to show that he has that closer type of you know, that he can be a closer, he could be the regular go-to ninth inning guy. I don't think the Royals are adverse to that at all. But I do think they're going to start playing the matchups a little bit more, making sure, you know, guys are who's available, who can lock down those 7, 8, 9 innings based on who they'll be facing. So I thought that was a really, really good switch. It was very telling as to how the Royals are trying to operate this past weekend, moving Smith out of the closer role, getting him right before he goes back into those really high leverage situations. So I thought, you know, that was really interesting and something that they'll continue to do moving forward.
Andy Rogers is our guest. I know that one of the hopes for the Royals was that bringing in a couple of veteran starting pitchers like Michael Wacha and Seth Lugo would have a positive impact for the younger Royals starting pitchers. And it seems like they've come together very well. And so far, Wacha and Lugo have been the mentors that the Royals are hoping they would be. And I've seen some of the quotes of Wacha talking about how impressed he's been with Brady Singer and Cole Reagans and even Alec Marsh. And it seems like Marsh and Singer and Reagans are taking the advice and taking the mentorship, because it's a two-way street. You got to have the young players or pitchers willing to listen, and you have to have the veterans willing to help and give ideas or help mentor them. But it seems like that plan that the Royals had, it's working out so far. Clearly on the field, but also it looks like they're coming together with good chemistry off the field as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's what you want to see from all those guys. You know, they're having meetings in the dugout after a starter comes out of the game, talking about what went right, what went wrong, what he could have done, what are the things that he did well. I thought it was interesting the other day, Marsh was warming up for his start in the bullpen, and the rest of the starters were behind him in the bullpen watching him warm up. They walked to the dugout with him from the bullpen out in right field. That's cool. You don't see that every day. You see that a lot in spring training, but not so much in the season. So just a really cool chemistry going on right now. I hope they can continue it even when maybe things aren't going as well, because, you know, there's always those ebbs and flows during a season. So that'll be the real test, is how can they continue that throughout the full 162 games and help them get through that long season.
Offensively, the Royals are the most powerful team in baseball. How surprised are you by the home run output, particularly considering how many games they played at home so far?
Yeah, it's been interesting. You know, especially with some of the players we're seeing hit homers, like Michael Garcia. I wrote about his power coming on a couple weeks ago. We're just seeing that more and more. So it's interesting with Kauffman Stadium, it being so windy lately. I don't know what's going on, but certainly the Royals are pretty happy about it.
And one of the big, to me, one of the big X factor. Stephen loves when I use X factor.
That's right. Not really.
But as go a ahead. Person, but I'm trying to think of another term. But to me, one of the biggest variables for this
wild
offense
card.
There you go, wild card. MJ Melendez, and I feel like it was maybe more important for him to get off to a hot start than some other guys, just considering he's still trying to establish himself. What have you seen from him? How significant is it that they're getting production from him early in the season?
It's probably the most significant thing about this offense right now. I think as far as MJ Melendez goes, I mean, he is the key, because you know what you're going to get out of Bobby. You know what you're going to get out of Salvi. And, you know, Vinny's struggling right now, but you hope that he gets back to his normal. What's really key for me is MJ Melendez and the way that he goes about his season. And if he reaches the power potential that everybody, all scouts and evaluators and officials have told us that he has this year, I mean, that's going to unlock this offense, because that gives more protection for the other guys. He's got so much strength in his bat, and then he can also, you know, he's got homers, but he can, you know, hit doubles. get guys over, things like that. I mean, that's going to be a major key for this offense. So it's really good to see how he's going, some of the adjustments that he made last year continuing into this season. And I, you know, you hope that he can continue that, because if he can have this kind of offense throughout the whole year, that's going to unlock a lot of things for this Royals offense beyond just what Bobby Witt Jr. and Salvador Perez can do.
All right, another young player that the Royals like is Michael Massey. How close is he to returning to action at the big league level?
He still needs a couple games on his rehab assignment. He got transferred up to Omaha this week, so we'll get more of an update on him later today, just on how many more games he might need. But he's only got 4 at bats, I think, and they're all strikeouts, so he definitely needs to get his timing back. The weather has been not kind in Arizona and in Arkansas as well to help him get those full that full work in. So he needs to get his timing back, and so he'll be there for at least a few more games, maybe more, and we'll get more information on kind of how that timeline works later today.
Now, you mentioned, what the Royals will be facing over the next couple of weeks. This is a really good test with the Houston Astros. It looks like they're getting hot right now, and their bats are waking up. And so we should, I mentioned, look, last year you look at the probable pitchers and it didn't make you feel great about the Royals' chances. You look at this one, Cole Reagans tonight, Seth Lugo, Brady Singer. This is going to be a real nice test for the Royals to see where they're at. Maybe give us just a quick preview of what you're looking for in this series between the Royals and the Astros.
Yeah, really excited for tonight to see what Cole Reagans can do against that lineup. Like you said, they're... The bats are getting hot. They faced a pretty good Rangers team this weekend, so it'll be fun. I love it. It's kind of exciting to say, hey, like, let's look at the pitching matchups, and you can get excited about who the Royals are putting on the mound, and you can get excited about that lineup. They're coming off an off day, and so they'll be fresh throughout the entire roster. So that's exciting. I think that's the biggest one for me, is seeing what Cole Reagans can do against that lineup, and. We'll see what happens, right? I mean, last year, I think the Royals kind of burst onto the scene, like, against the Astros in September. I mean, they were way out of it, but I think a lot of people took notice, and I think that's kind of what showed the Royals, both in the front office and in the clubhouse, that they've got pieces to build around. I don't know. We'll see what happens this year, and starts this week, and they've got a tough schedule, in the last couple of weeks of April. So it'll be interesting to see how they kind of navigate that and how they come out of it.
Hey, one more question for you before we let you go. The Royals did recently make a trade. They acquired Colin Selby, right-handed pitcher from the Pittsburgh Pirates, in exchange for minor league lefty Connor Oliver. And Selby was then assigned to Omaha. What do we know about Colin Selby?
Well, he spins the ball really well, and that's the makeup of some Royals pitchers that they've acquired over the last year or so. With the pitching coaches, what they like to do with these guys, if you can get kind of a high octane arm who spins the ball well, see how you can help him refine the zone and find his command and see what he can do for you. So he fits that mold. We'll see if. We'll see if there's anything there as he gets to Omaha and starts working with the coaches there. But this is what the Royals need to do. If there's waiver claims, if there's players who have been designated for assignment like Selby was, and they can make a small trade, things like that, anything that they can do to make them more competitive, add depth, things like that, this is absolutely what they need to do. So we'll see how he shakes out over the next couple of weeks in Omaha.
Annie, as always, thanks for the time. We appreciate you.
All right, guys. Thank you.
That's Annie Rogers, covers the Royals for MLB.com. Royals Astros with Cole Reagans on the mound tonight at Kauffman Stadium. Back after this on WHB.
He's got a counter move. Edie with the left hand.
And that's part of his game he's improved on. That left hand right there. Take away the left shoulder.
They're usually good at the end of shot clock. Switch it. Klingon asking for it. Spencer bottoms.
That'll make you good, huh?
Yeah, what they got is Heidi is a good defender, can make threes. McGillis a good passer and pick and pop. Smith upstairs. Jumbo jam. Zach Edey. Hankins got to get touches on the other, make this guy work.
It's Udy.
Wow.
Okay. I mean, great steal. The big fella runs the court.
Spurts, screens, slips.
Good defense right now.
It has been. Castle, the floater goes. He can elevate over most.
Lawyer, feed it. Edie, missed it.
Major highlight from Heidi.
Spencer doesn't go. Rebound. Castle is there. Can't get it on the first cleanup, and he put it over Edie for two.
They're out-rebounding Purdue 33-24.
They grind you till you slip and pull asleep.
Castle, that's clever. Spencer stops, pops. Yes, sir.
Wow.
He's got some stuff.
Spencer for higher.
Nice. Jones blocked by Spencer.
Caravan takes the big pass.
Fling it. Yes.
And how about Caravan? Silently contributes to the cause.
UConn fans on their feet behind head coach Dan Hurley. Shot clock down to four. Caravan floated. Fling in. Exclamation point with a layup. It is a UConn coronation. The Huskies make history. Back-to-back national champions.
I just think it's the best two-year run, I think, in a very, very long time, just because of everything we lost from last year's team. To lose that much and again, to do what we did again, it's got to be as impressive a two-year run as a program's had since prior to whoever did it before Duke. To me, it is more impressive than what Florida and Duke did. Because they brought back their entire teams, and we lost some major players.
UConn's been running for the last 25-30 years. UConn's been running college basketball, and I see all the former champs over there, and we've been running college basketball the last 30 years. Let's go.
Welcome back to the Border Patrol on Sports Radio 810 WHB. Here to talk about UConn running college basketball for the last 25 to 30 years, our good friend Mike DeCourcy from the Sporting News. Hello, Mike. How are you?
I am well, Stephen. How are you?
Oh, I'm great. The bracket contest I was in, I had UConn beating Purdue in the championship. And so I did very well. So I'm very pleased with the outcome. But I can tell you who's not very pleased, Mike.
And who would that be?
Jake Gutierrez. He's trying to put on a friendly face and some laughs and giggles. But I've watched him. He does not like the Dan Hurley proclamation that UConn has been running college basketball for the last 25 or 30 years. I'd like to get your response to Dan Hurley letting people have it and letting them know it after winning back-to-back championships.
Well, how many is that now? It's 99 and
it's six.
04. And
six of them.
Six of them? That's a lot.
Yeah.
That's pretty impressive, and they've done it under three different coaches as well.
Just a few more. They've won a few more championships. Eight times they've missed the tournament. They've almost won as many championships as they've missed the tournament.
And there it is.
The 25-year span.
there it is.
I did an article about that all the way back around 2002 or so. And I talked to Jim Calhoun about the fact that the way their program was built, now things are different now, but the way their program was built was they would cycle up to that big year because they would bring in a group, Rip Hamilton and or someone like that, or Ray Allen, and as freshmen they would just be okay and maybe miss, and then they'd get in, and then they'd get in and make a little bit of a run, and then they'd get in and win the whole thing, and that was the way it was then, and I think there's still some similarity to that now, but I don't think Dan Hurley's going to settle for that going forward. We'll see how it goes, but they're going to lose a lot from this year, but hey, they lost 75% of their scoring from the 2023 champions.
Wow.
In recorded history, and when I say recorded history, I say that because I can't find online the stats for Oklahoma State in the middle 40s which was the first team to win consecutive championships. Their player stats are really hard to find. However, they had a star player named Bob Curlin, who was a 7-foot center. In those days, 40, 50 points was a lot for a game. And Bob would average about 20. So I don't think they lost 75% of their scoring because Bob was on both teams. And from then on, Kentucky in 48-49 and San Francisco in 54-55, Cincinnati 61-62, and then the UCLA teams and Duke and Florida, nobody ever lost close to 75% scoring. What Connecticut did last night, and we don't get this a lot in sports now because we've had sports for so long, is unprecedented. You don't get unprecedented very often anymore. But what they did by winning last night's championship, Florida, they brought back their whole team. Duke brought back everybody but a 14- or 15-minute-a-game player in 91-92. Even when UCLA was going from Kareem Abdul-Jabbar to Sidney Wicks and then to Bill Walton, they weren't losing as much of their team, even losing the all-time greatest college basketball player in Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. UCLA still didn't lose as much of its team as UConn did from 2023 to 2024. And UConn got better.
And maybe the part that blows me away the most about it, Mike, is it comes during a time in the college sports landscape in which legends like Nick Saban are walking away from the game because, in his own words, all players care about now, all they want, the only question they have for you when they come on campus is how much money do you have for me? And this guy, and Dan Hurley, is coaching NBA prospects, and they're playing team-first basketball. They're playing unselfish basketball. And I feel like that's always been a challenge for coaches to get, like, elite players to buy in. That's what makes guys like Bill Self special. He's been able to do that. Isn't it more impressive to do it right now than any other time that we can think of in college basketball history?
Well, you know, first of all, let me say, in all due respect to the greatest college football coach who ever lived, that was a total crock. It was insulting, and it was garbage. For someone making $9 million a year to say to someone whose family, who may not have been above the poverty line, all you care about is money, is extraordinarily insulting. And he should be ashamed of having said that. I'm glad it wasn't a basketball coach who said it. Let's put it that way. Because that's obviously the sport that I care about the most. When I sign on for a job, do you think I'm going in and saying, "Oh, pay me whatever"? I mean, I want to be paid what I'm worth, and then you're going to get everything. Everything that I have to give, you're going to get it. And so when Cam Spencer transferred from Rutgers to UConn, I'm sure that he was told there would be a certain pool of NIL money available to him. But did Cam Spencer not give UConn everything that he had in his one season as a Husky? I mean, you saw him last night. You saw a guy who was he was putting every ounce of energy he had into winning with his team. Even though they were new teammates, less than a year ago, not teammates, and he put everything he had into that. That's what all of business, employment or engagement, it's what all of it's about. You are going to be compensated, and then how much are you going to give in exchange for that compensation? And if I'm a football player and I go on Alabama's campus and I see a 100,000-seat stadium and I see network television every single weekend, of course I would like my share. But if I'm a great player, a committed player, I'm going to give Alabama everything I have in every practice and every game that I'm healthy to play. And I don't think there's anything wrong with the player wanting to get a reasonable share of compensation in exchange for all those efforts.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I don't think that, that Saban was saying that that shouldn't – I don't want to put, get into his words, but I think that the idea is that the only thing you care about. You know, like if you're going for a job interview, you want to know, is there room for growth? Am I going to be given the tools to get better at my craft? Am I going to be given the opportunity to move up the ladder? You know, those types of things would matter to you too. The money might matter the most, but those other things matter. I was trying to give a compliment to Dan Hurley from the standpoint that, I don't know, it doesn't seem to me like everybody gets – that type of play. And it's not just giving everything you got. It's also that mentality that I might not score as many points as I could on another team, but I'm going to do what's best for the team to win. Isn't that harder to do with kids that are five-star recruits and pro prospects and all that, or no?
But they don't have that many five-star guys. They have one five-star guy on that team. That's, you know, I think what's hard to find now, and this is what goes, and this is really what Jim Calhoun was great at, and what Dan Hurley has continued. Jim Calhoun was the best scout of any coach that I've ever covered over my 30 years now at Sporting News. He was the best scout. He saw players. He saw Shabazz Napier, what was possible with him that others did not, and that was his great skill. That was his superpower as a elite Hall of Fame coach. And I think Dan has continued that to a large degree. They identified Steph Castle very early. He was, I think, a sophomore or junior year commit to them. He was not a local kid. Donovan Klingon grew up, 40 minutes from UConn's campus in Bristol. And so he was a local kid and not an easy recruit to get, but an easy recruit to want because he's tall and super agile and a really great kid and right down the road. But Steph Castle, of all people, down in Georgia, and you find him and you get him in your program that quickly, I think that was impressive. And that's what I think Dan has been really great at. There are lots of programs, honestly, where coaches get guys to commit to playing together and playing hard and playing for each other. I mean, I think that's more common than not. But you have to have great players, significant players, who are willing to do that, as the Jayhawks did in 2022, and as the Huskies have done for each of the last 2 years.
Mike DeCourcy is our guest. All right, let's get to the juicy stuff. I've been very excited to ask you about this. What did you think of John Calipari going to Arkansas? And then give us a list of realistic candidates to replace him at Kentucky.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I right away when I start to see the names, I know how it works now. It's not easy to get a coach from a major program now because with NIL, the ability to compensate the players, the difference between a Kansas and let's say. I'm trying to think of an Illinois. Just to use an example that sort of hits home. The difference between a Kansas and an Illinois is not as profound as it was in 2003. It can be if you have Bill Self. Certainly the difference between a game at Illinois is really cool. A game at Fog Allen is legendary. But that's not going to impact the players as much as it's going to impact somebody like me who walks in to cover the game or somebody else who buys a ticket and goes and sits to the stands. I think the players are going to come to really embrace that. But their first concern is, am I going to be coached by a guy that I believe in and that believes in me? And am I going to get the best possible, not necessarily the most, but the best possible package to make my life, my family's life better? So the difference between those elite programs and the next level is not as profound as it once was. And another part of that is like an Alabama with Nate Oates. Alabama's drawn 110,000 people for their football games. They can pay whatever they want. And 20 years ago, 25 years ago, they weren't that interested in basketball. But now, it's kind of cool to be good at basketball. And it's profitable to be good at basketball. So why not be good at basketball? So they're going to pay Nate Oates what they need to pay in order to be good at basketball. And so there's no need for Nate Oates to throw his whole life into chaos and start all over again in another program just because it's got a better brand. He's being extraordinarily well compensated where he is. He's got long-term security. So it's not necessary to go to. And so Kentucky fans are furious with me because I said, look, you're not getting Nate Oates. You're not getting Jay Wright. Here's who you might get, Sean Miller. And they're super mad at me for that. But we already have Nate Oates out of the picture. We already have Jay Wright out of the picture. We already have Dan Hurley out of the picture. And we've not even been 24 hours into this, 48 hours into this. It's the nature of things now. You're almost certain to get somebody from a slightly lower level. Now, as we go forward, we don't know where this is all going to go with the SEC and Big Ten. That divide might be now that the slightly lower level is a program in a Big 12 or a program in, let's say, the ACC. It might be. I'm not saying for sure, but it might be because of that money divide between the two money leagues and everybody else.
You think Coach Kyle is going to be successful at Arkansas?
Oh, I would say yes. He's going to have a massive NIL pool. He's a terrific coach, and he's going to get significant players to come out and play for him. And I think that his experience at Kentucky has been instructive, that he needs to be as multifaceted as possible in his roster construction. I think he gets too much. I think there's too much. It's too much easy criticism of him. Oh, all he does is go out and get freshmen. Really, like, who else had a player for here in the first years of the portal era? Actually, technically before, he brought in Oscar Tshiebwe. He brought in Kellen Grady from Davidson. Kellen got hurt at the end of his 1 year as a Wildcat. Trey Mitchell, he brought in this year. Antonio Reeves was a third-team All-American as a transfer. They were not well positioned at the most important position this year, point guard. And usually they have been young at that spot. But this year they were young and they were not capable. They were talent, but they weren't point guards. I mean, Reed Shepard was really never really a point guard before he started to do it for Kentucky because no one else could do it. But you can't be naked at that position and win big in college basketball. And I think that was John was reminded of that this year.
All right, so just we'll wrap it up with this. Say there's a guy named Jake that might like to place a wager on the next Kentucky coach. Who's the favorite? You think Sean Miller's the guy? Give me a name that Jake can hang on to.
My list, I had the first two names were Mark Pope, who Kansas fans are familiar with now. He was a part of the greatest college basketball team of during my career of covering the sport, and that was the 1996 Kentucky team. He was an important part of that team, and he's now a successful coach at BYU. And so that, I thought, might be appealing to Kentucky, the alum, the really solid guy who also plays a very attractive brand of basketball. I thought that would be appealing. And then if that were not, my next suggestion was Sean Miller. Now, look, they're going to go after Scott Drew, and they're going to offer him a lot of money. But is, first of all, why would Scott Drew leave a championship that's got, you know, it's only, 3 years old? You still got at least 2 years before anybody can even ask you where the bathroom is. No one can bother you when you've got a title that fresh. That's why the whole Danny Hurley thing was preposterous. He's got two trophies on his desk. Nobody can say anything to him. And Scott's got that. And he's been a top three seed in every year this decade, including 2020 when they would have been a one like KU would have been. So what can Kentucky give you that you don't have? A little bit more money, yes. But honestly, I like Scott a lot, and I think he's a fabulous coach, and I think he's done a phenomenal job at Baylor. I don't think Kentucky is the place for him. I just don't think that his personality is going to fit with that. It is not just coaching at a place like Kentucky. It's a lot more, and John got that and was better at that than anybody's ever been, probably. But then when they turned on him because they started losing tournament games, you know, that went away, and it it became a negative environment. I don't think that Scott, in much the same way as Archie Miller when he went to Indiana, it just wasn't right for him. I don't think that Scott, that's a right place for Scott. I think in the end he would find it uncomfortable.
Mike, thank you so much for the time. We appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
That's Mike DeCourcy from the Sporting News. Back after this on WHB. Thank you to all of our guests today. We talked to former Royals reliever Jamie Bluma in studio. Mark Boerichter, former Chiefs wide receiver, was also in studio. Mike Boddicker, former Royals starting pitcher, was also in studio. Annie Rogers, who covers the Royals for MLB.com, called into the show, as did our college basketball insider Mike DeCourcy from the Sporting News. If you want to listen to any of those interviews, if you missed them, check out 810WHB.com and go to the podcast page and listen to any of those conversations. You can also listen to Nate admonish Pro Football Focus and Jake get irritated with Dan Hurley telling him that UConn has been running college basketball for the last 25 or 30 years. Dan Hurley told Jake, put that in your pipe and smoke it. And also have a great day right here on Sports Radio 810 WHB.